the measurement issue that I'll be talking about is around capacity to consent for including people with intellectual disabilities in research. And the specific example study that I'm using is a study of a health promotion intervention, a randomized control trial of a health promotion intervention that's currently in progress. I have no relevant relationships to disclose. The project was funded by the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, but of course the content of this presentation does not necessarily represent official views of NICHD or the National Institutes of Health. So the real issue here is that people with intellectual disabilities are often not included in research for a number of reasons, some of them perfectly legitimate. They may just not be the population of interest for a particular study, or the study may actually not be appropriate for people with intellectual disabilities if it requires responses that involve a lot of complex cognitive capacity. However, there are some reasons that people may not be included that may not actually be founded and that can be addressed. One of those is fear that institutional review boards will not approve studies that involve people with intellectual disabilities. And interestingly, researchers may actually be limiting ourselves more than institutional review boards would. If we submitted the studies. A colleague of mine from my grad school days, Dr. Katie McDonald, did her dissertation research on views of researchers and IRB members on including people with intellectual disabilities in research. And one of her findings was that when presented with a variety of scenarios of different types of studies involving people with intellectual disabilities, researchers were actually more likely to say that the study would not be approved by an IRB. The IRB members were generally saying that given adequate safeguards, they would approve the study and that there would be no reason not to include people with intellectual disabilities. Another concern is that even if the study is approved, would people with intellectual disabilities be able to provide informed consent? If they can't do it themselves, who else would do it, and what would the process for that be? Despite potential barriers, of course, we know that including people with ID in research is important, partly because it's not ethical to exclude people from research that might benefit them. And this is one of the reasons that IRB members are actually trying to encourage inclusion rather than exclusion. And of course, we all know that there's a need for research addressing the needs of people with ID. And another thing is that many people with intellectual disabilities may actually want to participate in research and have that opportunity, and at the very least, they should be given the opportunity to say no if they don't want to, rather than it just being assumed that they won't participate. So the purpose of this presentation is to describe one possible strategy to provide people with an opportunity to participate in a study and a process to help find out if they need assistance with making decisions about the study. So again, the example that I'm using is called the Healthy Lifestyles for People with Intellectual Disabilities Study, or HLID for short. This is a randomized controlled trial of a health promotion intervention, the Healthy Lifestyles for People with Disabilities program. This is for people with mild or high-functioning moderate intellectual disability, so that's something to keep in mind as I'm going through this. Also, it's pretty basic health education stuff. It's providing information and skills, helping people set goals. So there's nothing invasive or likely to be dangerous about it. It is considered a low-risk study. Now, at Oregon Health and Science University, our institutional review board has actually put together a document providing guidance on what they've determined, including decisionally impaired adults in research. So that includes a number of different groups who may have difficulty with decisions for a variety of reasons, ranging from complete inability to make decisions, for example, someone who is unconscious, in a coma perhaps, and would need somebody else to make decisions completely on their behalf. There's also fluctuating decisional impairment, for example, with a progressive condition like Alzheimer's, ability to make decisions may decline over time. For someone who's had a stroke, it may actually improve over time as they recover from the stroke. And then the category that's of most interest with regard to intellectual disability is a category called limited decisional impairment, and that's for people who have some ability to express their wishes but may just need some help making decisions, and the level of decisional impairment is not expected to change over time. The purpose of the policy really is twofold, to protect people's right to take part in research if they want to, but also to protect them from being pressured to be in a study if they don't want to. So it's really about balancing the risks and benefits of research. One of the things that the policy states that I particularly like is not to assume that someone cannot provide informed consent. The first priority is always to try to get informed consent from the actual research participant if possible. But in some cases, there may be a need for a surrogate or proxy or someone just to provide some assistance with making decisions. And the term that they've chosen for that person who would help out is an authorized research representative, or ARR. Even if an ARR is used, assent is still needed from the individual. So that's just a simple agreement to participate as opposed to the more detailed understanding required for informed consent. The policy doesn't specify who the ARR should be. It gives some examples of types of people it could be. So it could be a parent or a spouse or other relative, as long as that person is an adult and has capacity to provide consent. It could be a legal guardian. It could be a staff person or a personal assistant. It could even be a trusted friend, again, as long as that person is an adult and able themselves to provide consent. This is a distinct category from legal guardianship. So someone might be his or her own legal guardian, but still need assistance with making decisions. So the ARR is only authorized to help with decisions in that particular research context. It doesn't apply to any other areas of the person's life. And one thing that the policy states is that ideally, the person with, in this case for our study, intellectual disabilities, should decide or have some say in who the ARR is. It is up to the researcher to determine how we'll figure out who needs an ARR. There's no specified process for that. However, it does have to be reviewed by the IRB and approved prior to beginning the study. So researchers need to think through what their steps are going to be, keeping in mind that more detailed understanding will be required for higher risk studies. What we do in the HLID study is once people have expressed a general interest in being in the study, we explain the study to them in more detail, including exactly what they'll be doing, what will be expected of them, what the possible risks and benefits are. We also explain some of the concepts that they would need to understand in the consent process, such as what voluntary means, that it's your choice whether or not to do this, what confidentiality is, that no one but the research staff will see your answers or your information. And then we ask just a few simple questions about the study. And if the person has a little bit of difficulty answering some of the questions, we'll explain again and give them a second chance. The questions that we're using, there are just six of them. The first one is, please tell me in your own words, what is this study about? So just trying to see if they generally understand it. The second one is, what will you be doing if you take part in this study? And the third one is, what are the risks of being in this study? When I say you're taking part is completely voluntary, what does that mean to you? When I say that your answers will be kept confidential, what does that mean to you? And what can you do if you start the study but don't want to finish it? And if the individual is able to answer all of those questions, then they're considered capable of providing informed consent. Now, if they're not their own guardian, their legal guardian would still need to sign the consent form, but that's a separate issue from the capacity to consent. If they're able to answer some of the questions, but not all of them, that's when we ask if there's a relative or a staff member or someone else that they can bring with them to the first project meeting to help them make decisions about the study. If they're not able to answer any of the questions, we do actually exclude them from this particular study, since it is a health promotion intervention that's providing information. they need to be able to understand and engage with that information at least somewhat. But the primary focus is not on exclusionary criteria, but on identifying needed accommodations to be included. This is a study that's still in progress, but so far we've screened 97 people. Of those, only 7 people have been unable to answer any of the questions. 20 of them were able to answer some of the questions, but not all, and did need an ARR. And 70 were able to answer all of the questions themselves. The process, regardless of whether or not an ARR is used, is pretty similar once we actually go to obtaining consent. We meet with them and go through the consent form, basically walk them through, again, what will be involved in the study, what the risks and benefits are, what they can do if they decide they don't want to be in the study once it's started. People providing their own consent can then sign the consent form. People using an ARR, the ARR will sign the consent form, and the individual with an intellectual disability will sign a very simple assent form. So our conclusions are that many people with mild or moderate intellectual disabilities can understand a low-risk study enough to provide informed consent. In fact, for us, it's been 72% of the people that we've screened were able to answer all of the questions. For those people who aren't able to answer all of the questions, the use of ARRs can help more people take part in research. In our case, 22% of our participants did need an ARR, and without that option, they would have been excluded from the study. So for us, this process has worked quite well for a low-risk health promotion study. A similar process could probably work well for other studies of people with intellectual disabilities, and could even help include people with intellectual disabilities in general population studies. And I thought I had one more slide. Okay, I thought I had my contact info up there. I'll just tell you my email address is hornerjo@ohsu.edu, and I'm happy to share more information about this.
Let's have the first question.
Okay. If I may say, I wanted to compliment all the speakers on the panel. That's the program that did great. I have probably a question for all of you, but I wanted to ask Gloria. There was something really important I found about that work that you did in the sense of disentangling kind of the health perspective from the function perspective. And I was actually very struck by the fact that there was no correlation between the functional limitation and the self-reported health. But what about if you had chosen a population that had functional limitations that were associated with a chronic condition? Obviously they would be correlated because the extent of the health condition would be correlated with the mobility limitation, which is also correlated with health status. Could you use the same method, and could you try to disentangle the extent to which it's a kind of pain, fatigue, that kind of thing, versus functional limitation?
I think it's a great question, Steve, and I appreciate that. I think you really got what we were trying to do. We see this as really a kind of a small study in this whole process of trying to figure out what are health disparities, how do we disentangle what are pre-existing components of what's related with the functional impairment from what is the functional impairment, and that historically it's all been kind of bundled, and so we really don't know what's going on. So we used that the data set with spinal cord injury because we thought it was really pretty clean. If we could disentangle there, we could at least show what the problems are. We are pretty committed. At Oregon, and the Oregon group is continuing, and this is under really Warren Johnson's leadership at this point, with a national expert panel, really trying to build a measure of health, self-reported health status that does not get this functional bias included in it. And I think once we've got some of those cleaner measures, it was really interesting to hear the health utility, because we've been seeing some of the health utility index, for example, really being used as a status measure, when it really seems to largely function with a couple of items relating to pain, and I can't remember what the other one is. So, you know, what I'm really impressed with the entire panel is taking a step back and really trying to figure out what it is that we are measuring when we're measuring, so that the literature can move forward with some cleaner constructs. So, long way to say, I think that we need to get to those kinds of cleanliness in our measures in order to figure out what are these associations and what do they mean in the long run.
Thank you. Any other comments from anybody else?
I think this is a good follow-up. I'm Craig Ravislow, University of Montana. And for either Dr. Cron or Dr. Frick, or maybe both, do you think that we should be controlling for depression in these studies of self-rating health?
It's an interesting question, because specifically, I mean, within the instrument that I'm most comfortable with for health utility, depression is, in fact, it's one of the domains, so you really can't escape it, although, you know, as my colleagues were more careful, more interested in more careful measures of anxiety and depression, it's at best depressive symptomatology. Nevertheless, I think that it so affects how you would respond to self-rated health. You know, and in some other work that I've been doing, we were even trying to disentangle, you know, is it that people with glaucoma find themselves depressed because of the visual impairment, or is it that people who are depressed respond to visual activity questionnaires saying, well, I don't do it, but it really just reflects their depression rather than the vision. So, I mean, this is something that I think, I don't know if there's a single standard answer for it, but it's definitely something that we have to disentangle. What's the depression? What's another disease? How do they fit together?
I really concur with that, in sort of making sure that we're measuring those things that we think are important, and then figuring out what's relevant to the question. I'd really kick this question to Willie Horner Johnson, because she's actually giving me a heads up. She's just led a group in putting together a paper that really shows that at least vitality looks a little bit different in its relationship to other items of health. Health-related quality of life for people who suffer poor disability than others.
That's not actually the one I thought you were going to refer to, but I'll tackle that one. So what we found with factor analysis of health-related quality of life items from the BRFSS is that there's a little bit of a difference in structure for people with disabilities versus people without disabilities, where people with disabilities seem to be thinking of vitality, that question about how many days have you felt very healthy and full of energy, more similarly to the other physical health-related questions, whereas people without disabilities are thinking about them more similarly to the other mental health-related questions. So I'm not sure exactly what that means, but there do seem to be some differences based on disability status there. We've also found in the process of working to develop a measure of health that does not assume that people with functional limitations have poorer health, that people with mental health conditions scored lower on all of the domains within the measure, not just the mental health questions. So again, it's that question of, does the mental health condition impact how they're perceiving physical health, et cetera, or are they actually poor physical health and that's impacting their mental health?
Thank you. Next.
My name is Paula Minahan, and I also have a question about self-related health, but from another perspective. I do a lot of work with physicians around disability issues who have very little or no training or experience with disability. And in my experience, the whole notion that someone with a significant disability, for example, spinal cord injury, could self-report that their health status was good or very good or excellent, they're just incredulous. About that, and when I try and explain it to them, I've never really found a good way, a succinct way, for physicians to get that, and I'm wondering if any of you have come up with a way to talk with physicians around this very, very important notion. Thank you.
I just wanted to say there's a philosophy notion that is the happy slave syndrome, which is what folks use to say why people with disabilities, because they really don't understand, they're the happy slave, they really don't understand how bad they have it. But we have an example of a star in our midst. If Carrie Morgan, who just got back from Paralympics, could chat with those physicians, I think they might see something a little differently. Can you raise your hand, because you really are a star?